Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
China, they are usually the world's largest producer of cotton, but have had some trouble with that this year, expecting a crop of about 27 million bales, according to USDA. They were up over 30, almost going toward 31 last year.
Kevin Brinkley, CEO, Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
And their consumption is still strong at 37.5 million bales, so obviously they're going to have to bring some cotton in from somebody. And we got to keep our eye on those Brazilian guys and those Australian guys because they are certainly vying for this market. They can bring in about 4 million bales at a 1% quota, and anything above that gets a sliding rate applied to that. The current estimate is that they'll import about 10.5 million bales for the coming year, which we need them to do.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm going to give you a little bit of commentary here. Interest rates should probably never be zero.
Kevin Brinkley is the CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association, PCCA.
That is not a good policy for the country in terms of what it does to the markets and the market's ability to function, because you have businesses that can only survive when interest rates are near zero, and that's probably not letting the market clear effectively. What's amazing about this chart is not that interest rates are now in that 5 to 5.25% range that the Fed has targeted for short-term rate. It's how fast they got there. Everybody in this room, just kind of looking around here, everybody here probably had a mortgage. Almost everybody here had a mortgage that they paid 10, 12, 13% interest on at some point in your lifetime. So right now, you know, 7.5%, 8% mortgage rates don't sound all that bad, historically speaking. But this has been a meteoric rise from the Fed. Again, commentary on my behalf, but they waited too late to start raising rates to combat some of what they had done with zero interest rates. Tom mentioned the massive stimulus programs that went out as part of the fight on against COVID. And so they've had to do some things that they probably would have rather not done and raise rates really fast, really quickly. So why is the economy still cooking along if interest rates are so high? I like the way CoBank put this, that the Fed's probably going to keep things steady for a while, but the economic drivers here, Taylor Swift and Barbie and maybe the Oppenheimer movie, is just things come out in sort of a short period of time and consumers reach into their pockets and pull out either cash and or credit cards. And so this is what our economy has sort of been living on here. Our data here in the U.S. is the best that we have. And even though these exact same things are not happening in every country around the world directionally, they are probably good indicators of what is happening for other global economies. So what is the Fed aiming for? They've been raising rates really quickly, and what they say they're aiming for is that yellow line down there at 2%. That is the inflation rate that they want to target. This is their preferred measurement of how they're doing on that. This is the PCE. This is personal consumption indicators. A lot of us look at the CPI, Consumer Price Index. We all agree with it. Prices have gone through the roof on several things. But the Fed actually wants to know what are people spending their money on. And so you look at this chart, you'd have to say that what they've done in raising rates is probably somewhat working. I think you'll hear the term, if you listen to a financial program or something, they're trying to achieve a soft landing. We'll see if they get that done or not. You know, a lot of people will think about that, you know, in terms of just some regular commercial airliner. Can you get this down smoothly and not upset any of the passengers? And I will tell you, given the size of the U.S. economy, I think they're trying to land a C-130 on top of an aircraft carrier, is my assessment of it. But you look at this chart, you have to think they're having some success at bringing down inflation. Can they get it down to 2%, and does it need to be 2%, I think is the big question for our economy.
Kevin Brinkley, CEO, Plains Cotton Cooperative Association. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There are 7 different income tax brackets in play for all types of filers.
Bob Ray is CEO of the Illinois Farm Business Farm Management.
The tax rates are the same for all filers on the left. It just changes for their income levels depending on your filing status as married filing separate, whether you're single or head of household. You'll have different numbers in this middle column. We also note to the right side these effective rates that are reduced. If you're a farmer and you have Schedule F income and 4797 income, those are certainly two types of income that qualify for this qualified business income deduction. And the net result of that really means that your 22% marginal tax rate, for example, turns into an effective marginal tax rate of 17.6%. The key note here is you can have income up to about $364,000 and have a marginal tax rate, if CUBIT applies, of not more than 19.2%. These are the lowest rates that I've seen in my 40-year career of preparing tax returns, and they're also the highest bracket levels that we've exhibited for these lower rates as well.
Over the past 7 years, he says, machinery values have doubled.
If we look at 2021 and jump back to levels before that, you can see that if I go back to 2003, over that 18-year period, they've nearly tripled in value per acre. We know that two things are rising here. The value of the machinery asset itself is growing, and we have expanding farms, and their investment in machinery is growing as well. The machinery purchases are also increasing per acre. You see, this study was completed through 2021. Our 22 and 23 results are going to be very similar probably to this result in 21 at $67 an acre. And if I take that back to 2016, that's 5 years ago, those are up, you know, over 3 times just in that short time frame. But in 18-year period, you can see they're 4 times as much of an increase per acre. So we know that more purchases are being made and depreciation becomes a lot more critical element to the tax planning business side of farming. When you make these purchases, there are 3 types of choices available to affect the tax deduction. The first one, and they go in this order, is the 179 election, the expense election. That's a single dollar amount that you choose to deduct for each purchase item for each selected asset. Then we move to the second option, which is bonus. And in prior years, we've had none of this available. We've had 30% available, 50%. We've had 100% available. And you'll see we're going to add to the slide today, there's an 80% bonus deduction available in 2023. This is more lumpy. It's for a group of assets at a time that you're going to elect to deduct 80% or not deduct 80%. So it's much more lumpy, a wide choice of deductions compared to the 179, which can be elected really on a every dollar increment. The purchases are used as a cash expense. And this could mean that you are using what we call the de minimis rules, such as small materials and supplies. If you're spending under $2,500, then these could land in the cash expense category. Any amount that's not used under the 179 or bonus is going to be placed into our regular maker's depreciation life.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One particular issue that often comes up is that many of the products or specialty crop type products that might be available, so if you think about dry beans or just any of those type of residues that are out there, I mean, oftentimes there's a lot of chemicals or herbicides that would be used in those products that, you know, oftentimes there's really no consideration for grazing or haying considered on those labels.
Kansas State Extension Beef Cattle Specialist Justin Wagner.
So we really need to know, you know, when were those products applied? What were those products? you know, what are those label restrictions? That was one of the big discussion points with soybean hay this year is, you know, what products were applied. So that's a really good example of kind of knowing what's out there in terms of that. Even vegetable products, you know, we obviously know there's a lot of those products that are used, and they really just don't give much consideration that, you know, this could ultimately end up in a livestock stream. So they just don't tend to have that label approval. I think the other thing that's out there with alternative feedstuffs is we really have to understand that process, you know, giving some thought to, okay, what is this product? How is it produced? Are there any artifacts, you know, like those chemicals from the production? Maybe it's even the cleaning process of that particular factory. Is there something that could be a concern there? And so, you know, those are kind of the forefront of some questions that I would certainly advise producers ask that they're looking at some of those things is really get a full understanding and ask lots of questions about what this product is. The other side of that is the logistics, right? Okay, so we've got an opportunity to look at, you know, some brewery waste, for example. So how much of this product is going to be produced on a weekly basis? You know, if it's kind of a smaller brewery type setting, you know, you're getting a sense of, you know, what is that amount? How are they going to handle that product? How is it typically stored? How is it going to be delivered to you? In the case of some of these other products, we also have to think about, okay, well, if it's coming out of the human food stream and you think about best buy dates, one of the particular products that came across my desk a few years ago was a producer was looking at some coal produce waste that was gathered out of some grocery stores in some large metro areas. And so as you look at that, you know, obviously those products are coming in. They've been on the shelf for a while. If you think about, you know, best buy dates, you know, what's the stability of those products? What does that really look like? Is it something that we need to feed within a week? Is it something that we can create a system to store that product on farm and maybe get, you know, take a larger volume of that product in? So there's a lot of considerations as we start to think about alternative feedstuffs and just some of the different products that might be out there.
Talks about challenges with packaging.
You know, if we go back to that coal produce waste, obviously as they're removing that from the shelves, they don't take the packaging off. So in some cases, the packaging itself, you know, you think about, we really don't give much thought to packaging material, but if you think about the large rubber bands that are around produce, right? You know, if those are still in place, what's the implications of that? Some packaging can certainly be processed. Some of that packaging would need to be removed prior to feeding. You know, obviously some of that we can process, but it may pass through the animal and then it creates problem in the manure. So, you know, we have to be a little bit careful and maybe ask those questions. Certainly had another example where a producer was able to secure a fairly large volume of some breakfast products that were still in their foil wrappers. Obviously, as you start to look at that, well, what do we do with that? We've taken delivery of it on the farm. We could process that, but that could really create some problems for us later and in the facility. And so actually ended up removing those foil products was really what they thought was like the best option. So it's kind of a case of always ask those questions. How is this product going to come to us? You know, get a really good understanding of it. And many times those products, when we look at them, they're good feedstuffs, right? I mean, my two favorite words as a nutritionist are, you know, free and feed. But oftentimes, especially with these alternative costs, I like to say, you know, there's no free lunch, right? Even for cattle. So we've got to take those steps and evaluate those things. So we just always have to keep that in mind.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We have farmland that is leased, and the ownership of it changes hands. Of course, the tenant has possession for the term of the lease, and if there's an unexpired lease, the buyer takes subject to that unexpired lease.
Washburn University professor and tax law specialist, Roger McCowan.
We didn't have that situation in this case, although the existing tenant thought he could make that issue. What happened was that you had a tract of farmland that was leased under a written lease that was set to expire December 31 of 2018 by its terms in writing. This was not an oral situation, so we're not dealing with the March 1 date or giving notice 30 days prior to March 1. That's not an issue. This one terminated by its terms in writing as of the end of 2018. So the lease is over. The landowner who had leased that land, then since it's free and clear of the lease, or at least he's thinking it is, he sells the land to a third-party buyer. And this third-party buyer is out of state, and he buys the land, and he had the hay field fertilized. And then during the summer, he bought it in the spring of 19. During the summer, he hired another party, the defendant of the case, to cut and bale the hay, which was completed late one night. But early the next morning, the plaintiff, who was the old tenant, the prior tenant, came on the property and took some of the hay after it was harvested and baled. He just took it. And the new owner called law enforcement, and the plaintiff was informed, get out of here, don't come back. But he did. He came back to the property, took more hay. He gets sued criminally. He's charged with multiple offenses. And ultimately, he's convicted but gets a diversion in lieu of prosecution for the charges. He would have been convicted, I should say. So he gets a diversion in lieu of prosecution. The new owner didn't want that to happen, but that's just the politics of the local enforcement agency there. And he was required to pay restitution and perform community service. Well, he claimed, this prior tenant claimed that he was entitled to the hay bales because he had a verbal lease and tried to tender a rent check after removing the bales. Well, no, he had a written lease, and you cannot be a holdover tenant after the terms of a written lease have caused that lease to expire. This is not the situation where you had a verbal lease and then you weren't told to leave. You just continued on. That's a holdover tenancy. This was a situation where you had a written lease. It expired. You're done. There was no other side agreement or anything. And you're not a holdover tenant in that situation.
And a popular question.
When you sell your principal residence, your home that you live in and treat as your principal residence, you can exclude up to $500,000 of gain on a joint return. So you and your spouse can, if you sell your home, you can exclude up to $500,000 worth of taxable gain, and it's half that on a single return. But you have to, of course, meet the rules here. You have to own the home and treat it as your principal residence for at least two out of the last 5 years. The question that comes up in agriculture is how much land can I include with the sale of the home and have the gain excluded within that $500,000 limitation? So let's say I sell my home. I've got an acreage. I've got a farm. And maybe I'm selling the home for various reasons. I'm retiring, moving to town, whatever the case might be. And I've got $100,000 of gain in the home. But I've got $400,000 of that exclusion left to fill up. Well, can I take some of the surrounding land, sell that with the house, and maybe sell a house in 5 acres, a house in 2 acres, whatever the case might be, and also exclude the gain on the acreage under the home sale rule to fill up the balance of that $500,000 exclusion that I have? And that's a question I get all the time with respect to rural properties. And the answer is it depends. Clearly, the usage of land that's associated with the principal residence will count. So if I've got a garage, I've got some outbuildings, and those are used along with the principal residence, then the land associated with that will also count, or landscaped areas that maybe I've got a big yard, an acre or two that's a yard and it's all landscaped. It's part of the house, really. It's functionally part of the house. Well, we can do that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The trade agenda has been kind of lacking in certain respects. There's a lot of games that are being played by our foreign competitors. Look no further than even just south of us with Mexico and what they've said with respect to corn.
Tom Sell is with Combest Sell and Associates.
These trade challenges are always motivated by something, and usually it's a degree of competition and wanting to elevate domestic industry over the domestic industry over the needs of their consumers. We as the U.S. have the lowest trade barriers and the most transparent trade policy in the world right now. Maybe EU would be close, but they're bad actors on a lot of ag trade issues. So we need a very strong trade agenda. And again, this is one of those things where when we're organized around a farm bill, we can actually pursue some good trade agendas. This is another one of the things that's important in the farm bill. We have programs like MAP and FMD that need to be funded through a farm bill to help us compete and level the playing field and gain relationships, build relationships to access those foreign markets. Taxes is another big issue. You know, we had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in the Trump administration in 2017. A lot of those tax benefits are going to expire at the end of next year, at the end of 2024. And so a lot of those things will have to be re-upped. Think about estate taxes. Think about some of the tools like Section 179 depreciation or bonus depreciation. Even things like cash-based accounting for agriculture have been in the crosshairs in the past. The 17 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was a very good bill for agriculture in terms of how you can manage tax liability on your farm. Pay what you do, but you have some tools there at your disposal that can help farmers in the volatile nature of our business year to year. So tax policies are very important, and we're going to be very focused on that in 2024. And then regulatory policy. Look, this Biden administration does want to remake our American economy. I'm not exaggerating that. President Biden says it in his own way, right? And much of the focus is on climate smart type of policies coupled with the belief that climate change is a potentially catastrophic issue for the world. And so this has motivated most recently the Inflation Reduction Act, funny name, right, for a bill that spent a lot of money and probably caused some forms of inflation. But nevertheless, that's the creativity of politicians, right? Just call it, name it, and claim it the Inflation Reduction Act. It was a big bill, tons, significant tax measures related to clean energy, so-called renewable energy, and those types of things. These are also, some of those are going to be set to expire at the end of next year. Some have a longer clock than that. But this is big, big business in Washington, D.C., and it's important to fight for the needs of agriculture, which can be a big part of the solution, right? There's nothing that's more renewable or sustainable than agriculture, the work that y'all are doing on your farms, trying to get it better one year to the next, year after year, improve your capacity on that farm by taking care of the soil, taking care of your water resources, and all the resources at your disposal to do a better job next year than you did this year. That is the ethic and that is the beauty of the private property rights system that we know in the U.S., how you guys take care of your land and build it for the next generation. It's been an incredible blessing to this nation. But there's always this mantra out of Washington, D.C. that they know best, right? Or this belief, the classic Washington knows best mentality. I'm from Washington and I'm here to help. Let me tell you how things should be done to improve the way you produce on your farm. It's hubris. It creates some real problems, and you need strong organizations like PCCA, like Plains Cotton Growers and others, like the Southwest Council that we're fortunate to get to represent, to be there and be a voice for the family farmers who we believe know best how to pass that on generation to generation.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In the South, we will see half a dozen states come in and ending the season with topsoil moisture at least one half, very short to short.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey reporting significant very short to short topsoil moisture conditions in the final 2023 report.
Right at the top is Alabama, 74%, very short to short, followed by Louisiana at 72%. Some of that dryness still extends into the Midwest. Iowa will wrap up the year leading the Midwest, 67%, very short to short. And we see some of that dryness still patchy across the Great Plains, coming in at 61%, very short to short this week, a tie between Kansas and Colorado in the Northwest. Even though we've seen some moisture, it remains a bit on the dry side in some of our Northwestern states. Wrapping up this season, we'll see Washington State leading the Northwest at 51%, very short to short. Not too far behind Montana at 50%. I'll finish up with the Southern Rockies, where New Mexico has had a pretty disappointing autumn in terms of precipitation, and they lead the nation as we finish up the year here on November 26th, 78%, very short to short.
Digital Ag. What is it? Allie Nippert reports.
The K-State College of Agriculture, College of Engineering, and Colleges of Arts and Sciences have come together to launch the Institute of Digital Agriculture and Advanced Analytics. Kansas State University Precision Ag Engineer A.J. Sharda explains what this new institute is and how it plans to support innovations.
It's an interdisciplinary institute. We are faculty coming from multiple colleges, you know, College of Arts and Sciences, College of Agriculture and Engineering. This institute basically is a collection of faculty members who are really passionate about both digital ag and the advanced analytics component of it. We all believe that going forward, most agricultural problems, challenges, technology innovation, engineering innovation, digital solutions, agronomic solutions need to be interdisciplinary, and none of us can individually provide the best answers or solutions or technologies to the producers.
Research, teaching, and outreach are all important to K-State research and extension, and Sharda says they're also viable to the institute.
So this institute, which is formalized at K-State, actually intends to bring a lot more faculty into the fold of the institute, trying to develop individual verticals where people who are passionate about working in a specific topic or their passion is to develop teaching programs, you know, workshops, exchanging knowledge, doing outreach to people. So this institute intends to really take the all three components of land grant system, like research, teaching, extension, and go very boldly to tackle all these under the umbrella of, you know, digital ag and advanced analytics.
Sharda shares why they plan to collaborate with private organizations.
Our first biggest goal is to let people know that this institute is there. Let people know that the leadership at Kansas State University is all in about digital ag and advanced analytics. That's important for the state of Kansas. That's important for Kansas State University and for the faculty who really want to develop these disciplines. We want to reach industry. Already work with lots and lots of industry partners, but we are looking for one or two very strong strategic industry partners who can become the face for you know, hand-in-hand development of technologies and innovation and all those solutions.
That was Kansas State University Precision Ag Engineer A.J. Sharda on the Institute of Digital Agriculture and Advanced Analytics. This interdisciplinary team at K-State plans to work together to help solve challenges for producers. For more information on this institute, visit www.kstate.edu and search Digital Ag Institute or visit www.da3symposium.com. I'm Allie Nippert.
Thanks, Allie. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The notice is official. Funding applications are now being accepted for USDA's new Regional Agricultural Promotion Program.
We are announcing specifically the first $300 million of that tranche to be allocated. And the conditions we placed on the first $300 million is that they can be invested anywhere but in the top four agricultural markets.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack with the announcement Wednesday as a participant at the White House Export Council meeting. The $300 million tranche is part of a total $1.2 billion five-year funding availability from the Commodity Credit Corporation. One exception to the list of top export markets ineligible for use for RAP funding this first round.
We did not exclude Japan just simply because we saw a significant decline in market share in Japan, so we want to make sure that we are stepping up our game in a place where we think there's opportunity.
Applications are due by February 2nd, with additional information on RAP funding available at grants.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.